Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Our topic this hour is texting and tranquility, finding mental calm in a sea of technology and distraction. The statistics are startling. According to an online survey conducted in 2010, over half of those who responded reported feeling addicted to the internet. When the Pew Research Center polled smartphone users, they found that many check their devices up to 40 times an hour. Almost half of those polled reported sleeping with their phones next to their pillows, with the majority also experiencing so-called phantom rings, where they reflexively check for new email or texts, even when their phones make no sound. Does this sound familiar? While the science around addiction to technology is yet to be proven, there is growing consensus in the mental health community that the lure of digital stimulation is similar to that of other addictive disorders. Or addictive activities, actually. There is also evidence that breaking free from our digital lives can be extremely challenging on both an emotional and physical level. So why is it so hard to put down our iPhones and unplug our digital devices? What does technology do to the brain that makes it so seemingly addictive? How can people balance the urge to be online with the need for mental calm? And what is the impact of our digital lives on relationships, work, and decision-making? Tonight, we explore the emerging research about the addictive nature of digital devices and web technology and discuss the strategies that people are using to control the urge to be online and create more balance in their lives. We are joined by three Bay Area guests who each have unique expertise in this area. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Alex Soojung Kim Pong, and he's creator of Contemplative Computing, a framework for using information technologies and social media so they're not endlessly distracting and demanding, but instead help us be more mindful, focused, and creative. Alex is a senior consultant at Strategic Business Insights and has academic appointments at Stanford University and the Oxford University. He's also the author of the book The Distraction Addiction, which will be published this summer. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
And joining us by phone, we have two guests. First, Dr. Stephanie Brown, clinician, teacher, author, researcher, and licensed psychologist with over 30 years of experience in the field of addiction. She is the author of numerous books, including her new book entitled Speed, spelled S-P-quadruple-E-D, to be published next year, that explores the ways that people are becoming addicted to the fast pace of work and technology. Stephanie directs the Addictions Institute, an outpatient clinic in Menlo Park. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
And finally, we're joined by Dr. Nima Moraveji, founder and director of the Calming Technology Lab at Stanford University. In the dissertation for his PhD in Learning Sciences and Technology from Stanford, Nima coined the phrase calming technology. He teaches a popular course there called Designing Calm at the Stanford Design School, which students reflect, meditate, design, and test interactive products that help create calm for users. He's also the co-founder of Spire, maker of Breathware, a clip-on sensor that allows users to monitor their breathing throughout the day. Welcome, Nima.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
And welcome to you, our listeners. To join our conversation tonight, you can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We'll open our phone lines in about 15 or 20 minutes. You could also email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at kalw.org or on our Facebook page. So, Alex Soojung Kim Pong, I wanted to start with you. Why do we find it so difficult to unplug from our digital devices?
Because as humans, we have a kind of natural desire to extend ourselves through technology. You know, I think that one of the things that defines Homo sapiens is that our brains and our bodies are actually designed, or they've evolved to sort of meld with technologies, be they stone tools, million-year-old stone axes, arrows, swords, books, now computers, in ways that allow us to extend our abilities to sort of develop new capabilities or sort of new powers. And so our sort of engagement with mobile phones and Facebook and computers is just another expression of that. The problem is that these are devices that kind of have minds of their own and are sort of, you know, unlike, let's say, you know, a sword, which you can learn to control beautifully. A lot of mobile devices, a lot of smartphones, they're almost like sort of extra arms that sort of want to do what they want to do. So we can control them most of the time, but not all the time. And this creates all kinds of sort of problems, but it also ironically makes them just a little bit more addicting than they would be otherwise. The uncertain stimulus, the uncertain reward, sometimes is the one that, as it is in, let's say, gambling, the one that appeals to us most most powerfully.
So what I'm hearing in your initial comments there is that we have a tendency towards creating technology or tools, whether they be the literal, you know, swords and stone tools, to the sort of more figurative word of tool, to really dominate our environment, right, and to take control. And that in most cases over human history, that's been okay. And now the sort of tables are turned and the technology is now sort of finding a way to dominate us. We're not talking about artificial intelligence here, but there's a way in which there's more of a bi-directional vector there than perhaps the stone tools or the swords you were talking about.
Yes. I mean, in sort of bygone days, you would have a lifetime to master a particular technology or a particular craft. And I think that the sort of one of the challenges that we have now is that the devices that are part of our everyday lives, indeed, or of our everyday minute, as one Google executive sort of complained to me, is that they constantly change. We don't have years necessarily to learn how to use these so well that we kind of do so unconsciously, or without thinking about them. The way, let's say, we learn how to use a bicycle or skates or learn how to drive. Instead, we're put in the position of constantly having to relearn how to use email programs, different apps, or smartphones. And so we're always in this stage of being kind of eternal beginners in a way that I think we were not in of previous eras.
Just the fact that the rapid turnover of technology, the constant ability to be an experience to be novel in some way, is that what hooks us on some level?
In some ways, yes. That's part of it. I think that, you know, there were a whole bunch of reasons that I think people get develop relationships with technologies that feel addictive. You know, another part is that, as plenty of people talk about, there is a kind of neurological pleasant response that we get from getting new email or Facebook likes, the little dopamine hit, as people like to call it. Another, of course, is that these are sort of there is a social expectation often that we have to answer email quickly or, you know, answer text messages from friends or from kids. And so and that contributes to the sense that we have to stay online because, after all, other people are online. They're doing things, you know, they're tweeting stuff, they're having sandwiches. We might miss that. Now, the downside, of course, is that in the workplace, for example, the possibility of always being online, of always being connected and accessible to coworkers, to clients, morphs into having to always be online and accessible, which is why so many people feel the need to check their cell phones, to check their email right before they go to bed or within, you know, 30 seconds or a minute of waking up. And so there are these social pressures that, as with many things that can be addictions in our lives, start out as pleasantries, you know, turn into necessities, and then eventually morph into things that, you know, we just can't quit even if we wanted to.
Right, which is sort of gets back to that whole notion of addiction. I was just thinking as you were saying that, I don't know how long the iPhone allowed you to see if other iPhone users had actually read your text message. But when I found out that that was possible, it just totally changed my experience of sending text messages to people, because those people who I knew had turned on that function I could just monitor when they had read my text message and then could be sitting there sort of anxiously waiting for the response as opposed to, you know, not knowing if they had received it or not. And so anyway, I have not turned on that feature for my phone, so people don't know when I've read my text messages.
Good for you.
But I want to move on to Dr. Stephanie Brown. Welcome, Stephanie. I wanted to talk about, as a clinician, tell us a little bit more about how you're seeing the impact of this. And tell us a little bit about what you do. You really think that there is an internet addiction? It's sort of the term is, you know, used very loosely, but does it really follow with the clinical criteria that define other well-accepted addictions?
It follows closely and exactly. And I am glad to hear you say that it's used loosely. I hear some resistance to people really using the word addiction because that's very frightening. Very frightening because addiction means you can't stop. Addiction means you have a compulsion and you have to keep doing whatever it is you're doing. So most people in the culture are really terrified to think that they might have lost control. And the loss of control is behavioral, but it is also cognitive. It's complete thinking distortion, and it's emotional. In the culture and in a clinical world, a lot of people think, well, we just have to get a grip on this behavior. That is not what happens when you have addiction. You have to look at your thinking, the emotions that drive you, and addiction will lead to a tremendous sense of underlying terror, panic. And as people become addicted and are using the behaviors that Alex described, turning on in the morning, turning off in the evening, what's happening is they're having a range of emotion, feelings of craving, an internal urgency, the same kind of state of feeling and being that people have when they get up in the morning and they have to have a drink or a smoke or a needle of some kind. It's exactly the same phenomenon. And it's full of terror. And then as the addiction develops, people become more robotic with technology. And what they're experiencing is a loss of self, an emptiness inside if they're not in constant action, and numb. Ask people who are constantly hooked up about feeling, and they can't pause. They've lost the capacity for self-reflection, if they even value it anymore. Because we live with a value that speed is the ultimate success, that going faster and faster, a researcher calls it more, better, faster. That is the American way.
Well, it sounds like it's the universal way, but perhaps maybe more acute here in this country. I'm just reflecting on a study that was reported on in London's Daily Telegraph about a 2010 study at the University of Maryland that asked students from 12 universities around the world to unplug from all emails, texts, Facebook, Twitter for 24 hours. And I wonder if any listeners are just shuddering at the idea of me mentioning this. And a quote from that article said, they, meaning the study researchers, found that the participants began to develop symptoms typically seen in smokers attempting to give up. Some give up smoking, that is. Some of those taking part said they felt like they were undergoing, quote unquote, cold turkey to break a hard drug habit, while others said it felt like being on a diet. The condition is now being described as information deprivation disorder. And it's another person quoted in there said, who led the UK section of the study, said, we were not just seeing psychological symptoms, but also physical symptoms, which again speaks to this addiction model, right?
That's exactly right. That's the same thing that happens as people are in withdrawal from any kind of other addiction. I mean, including food, gambling, all the various drugs. It's the same thing. And, you know, you called it information deprivation. And I would like to note a question about that, because as people become addicted, they're not actually taking in the information. The behavior comes so rote that if you ask them, what have they just read, listened to, exchanged, people can't remember. People are so numb and so into the robotic state that they're not taking it in. And it's really an illusion to believe that there's a dialogue, a back-and-forth exchange of information between people in this kind of very, very rapid-fire, fast-paced exchange that goes on. When people are at the gambling table and throwing the dice, you know, the high is in the anticipation, the hope for a win, the grandiosity, the bigger-than-life, the sense of power the individual holds, and then the throwing of the dice. And then, if there's a win, that may continue. If not, there's a downer, there's a crash. But people are not engaged with others. There's a tremendous cost to relationship culture-wide because of this focus and the addictive nature of it on technology. And again, my focus is broader than technology, to the value of increasing speed.
Okay, so it's not just the technology, it's the
speed.
No,
it's not. And actually, let me put in here a note about that, because our language has changed. Our language has changed, and because of the dominance, I believe now, of a business mentality in the culture, that business thought, business economics and principles are the highest level we can strive for. Well, we now are living in a medication-managed culture. The words that have the highest value are shortcuts, efficiency. How can we get more for less? Less what? Less time, and definitely investment. In emotional investment, pausing, thoughtfulness, the kind of slowed-down state of reflection within oneself and within relationship and dialogue that will deepen intellectual exploration as well as emotional relationship, everything. We're living on the surface with each other, and the internet is reinforcing that very superficial surface quality.
So in there, you're basically getting at the fact that there is this experience that people are trying to get to a certain outcome, right? The engagement of technology, but then they get wrapped up in the experience itself.
That's exactly right.
And perhaps never actually make it to the goal.
The word outcome, because people are focused on outcome. People are focused on results. And many, many people don't have any sense of process, being in an experience anymore.
So I want to get to our third guest in just a second. But Alex, you were sending me a note there. You wanted to say something about how this the notion of addiction.
Yeah. And in the course of sort of writing my book, I looked at the history of the term addiction. And it turns out that it comes from this Latin word, addictus, which is effectively to be enslaved to someone else. So it was, if you couldn't pay off a debt, for example, it was a period of indentured servitude that you had to spend in order to sort of make good with your creditors. And it's in the late 19th century that the term addiction morphs from being something that describes a bad relationship to another person to being taking on the scientific and clinical term sort of overtones that it does today. And so in a strange way, when people talk about being addicted to Facebook or addicted to Twitter, there's a kind of curious double meaning now that, you know, sort of we're invoking both the sort of new scientific notion of what addiction is, but there is also this sort of curious overtone of the older idea of the term referring to sort of a kind of bad relationship.
Like cyber stalking, for example.
In a sense, yes.
Yeah. Well, an example of that being cyber stalking. So Nima of More Veggie, I want to bring you into the conversation just as a teaser, so to speak, for kind of where we can go moving forward as we deepen our conversation to understand the factors that lead to this so-called internet addiction, by giving us a little taste for how technology, which seems to be at the root of this problem, can also be a potential solution.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Brown had mentioned it earlier that it's not necessarily that the technologies are the cause, but they're really serving as magnifiers of existing proclivities, inclinations, anxieties, distractions of various sorts that maybe come under the umbrella term of, like, you know, the present moment isn't perfect. The seeking behavior, the brain must seek to find the grass is greener, something around there. Something is going on in the physical or social environment around me that makes me want to go and seek out or go and look into my technology or switch pages, switch tasks, constantly doing that. And at Stanford, you know, obviously Stanford is a place where a lot of these technologies have been created. However, it's also a place where people acknowledge this and want the good life, want well-being, and acknowledge this. And so what we did is we decided to marry these two worlds of well-being and technology and designing for well-being, specifically around this notion of calming technology, the taking on the biggest challenge there is, really. And, you know, when we talk about calming technology, we mean, when you say, well, what is calm? Calm is, as we define it, is the absence of anxiety. It's really our neutral state. It's our nature, in our way. A quarterback in the pocket is calm in order to be able to perform well. A communicator in front of 1,000 people is calm. Communicating with our loved ones when we're really feeling connected to them is calm. It's not necessarily relaxed technology or relaxing technology that we don't need to be, you know, kind of just slaying around. It's really just being our best, being able to perform clear-headedness, being present. And really, like, for example, we do a lot of different work in different ways. So for example, some of the work that we do brings awareness to people, to users, about how they're using the technology. You know, we have one prototype in our lab where every time you check your phone, there's the lock screen, there's a score on your phone that kind of starts at 100 at the beginning of the day, and then it goes down over the course of the day. And so it kind of goes down all the way to zero if you keep checking it, right? And again, not to place a judgment per se, but rather just to give you awareness about how you're doing this perhaps previously unconscious behavior. Other types of examples were more around, you know, okay, you know, you sat behind a computer all day and you've managing all this information going back and forth and interacting with all these people over email virtually, but do you actually feel the interaction that you're having with these people? Like, can you imagine them communicating these words and really feeling them and responding, or is it just shuffling around of bits and words? And so we designed interfaces where you'd see visualizations of, you know, every time you forwarded something, every time you replied, how many emails you were doing, how many times did you delete something? Every time you deleted something, instead of just going away and disappearing, having an actual emotional expression there where it would kind of crumple up and die or burn up, or if you really appreciated and loved an email that someone sent to you, you could draw a heart on it and it would play music and so on. So, you know, changing the interaction around email from this very robotic, mechanistic shuffling of bits into something more expressive and even adding something that we've been calling speed bumps. So when you're using your computer, it's very easy to be doing a single task and then immediately switch to the next thing as soon as you think of it. And so you don't have any in-between time. And that in-between time is very valuable because that's a time to kind of say, okay, well, maybe I need to, oh, I'm really constricted. My muscles are all tense. Oh, why am I so, oh, I need to take a deep breath. Okay, now I'll go on to the next thing. And do I really need to do this thing? Is this really my priority? And so on and so forth. All that happens in between, and that's really been going away in the name of efficiency, as Dr. Brown was mentioning. So we introduce in very compelling ways, and this is very important, in very compelling ways, these speed bumps. And when I say compelling, I mean we take the same capabilities of designing quote-unquote addictive technology or very compelling and interesting technology, intriguing. We take those same abilities and we apply them to calming technology. So we're not here to just promote, you know, hey, we shut off your computer if you use it too much and you can't use, you know, you've been a naughty boy and this kind of stuff, which is fine. And I, for one, totally acknowledge the utility of those. But there's another place for these kind of ideas, which is to go into the technologies that we use every day, the productivity tools, the social networking tools, and redesign them from the inside out to be adhering to human values throughout, you know, and that can come in a lot of ways. Those are social values, those are individual productivity values, and so on. So in the lab, when we talk about calming technology, it can take many different forms across email, across communication, across productivity, doing things, across even eating. We've got technologies that are working to help people be mindful of how they eat, the textures, the taste. Are they really present to their food, or are they treating it like a fuel? And that is what led to the company that we started, which is helping people breathe calmly throughout the day, develop awareness of their breath throughout the day using sensors, using interactive tools, because the breath is such a powerful tool for that.
And I'm going to insert a speed bump there. Very great teaser there to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about so-called internet addictions, where they come from, how they are taking over our existence and perhaps eroding it, and our experiences, that is, our human experiences, and what are some ways to combat it. With our guest, Dr. Alex Soojung Kim Pong, he's creator of Contemplative Computing and also senior consultant at Strategic Business Insights, and has academic appointments at both Stanford and Oxford universities, and is an author of the author of the book The Distraction Addiction, which will be published this summer. We're also joined by Dr. Stephanie Brown, clinician, teacher, author, researcher, and licensed psychologist with over 30 years of experience in the field of addiction, and she has a book that's coming out next year entitled Speed with 4 E's, and she also directs the Addictions Institute, an outpatient clinic in Menlo Park. And we were just hearing from Dr. Nima Moraveji. He's founder and director of the Calming Technology Lab at Stanford University, where he teaches a popular course called Designing Calm at the Stanford Design School. And it's time for your questions and comments. We open the phone lines to our listeners. 415-841-4134. Put down your tablet and pick up the phone. 415-841-4134. Or you can email us from your tablet or your phone, I guess, at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Or you can post a comment KALW.org or on our Facebook page. 415-841-4134. Again, our number. So I want to turn now back to the question of, now, we talked about the what happens with technology. Now I wanted to talk about the how. So what is the latest understanding of the brain science to link what we see in people's behaviors? So I wanted to start with you again, Alex. What do you know about the brain science in this area?
Well, I think that there have been a very large number of studies done now in which you, let's say, put people into fMRI machines that generate real-time pictures of what's going on in their brain and have them do things like multitasking activities or meditate or do other things. And what they're finding is that there are some pretty significant differences in the way that our brains work when we try to multitask, when we're trying to do something and we're interrupted, and we get off task and we have to go back on, versus when we're able to be calm in the way that Nima sort of described, or we're able to sort of focus and for an extended period of time try to clear our minds of everything. And it turns out that there are, I think, sort of the the two things that really impress me are, first of all, how high the costs are of multitasking or really switch tasking, where you're doing something and then you try to jump really quickly to something else. There have been studies that consultants have done that suggest that in the workplace, most knowledge workers lose an hour of productive thinking time to switch tasking. That works out to about 5 weeks a year, so probably longer than any of us get to spend on vacation. The other really compelling thing that the brain science shows us is the degree to which this kind of erosion of our attention and our ability to focus is actually reversible. That, you hear a lot about neuroplasticity, the idea that your brain continues to change even as you sort of get older. And it's absolutely the case that the internet changes the way we think or changes the way our brain works. Well, that's true partly because everything that we do changes the way our brain works. Learning to ski changes the way your brain works. But the other critical thing I think we're seeing is that when, let's say, you take people who describe themselves as very, very distracted, or of people who spend a lot of time on social media, for example, and you put them through a course on meditation, at the end of that, put them back in the fMRI machine, their brains behave differently. They are far more capable of keeping themselves on task, keeping their minds focused than they were sort of earlier. And I think that's the really, really good news in all of these studies, which, it's not just that the internet changes our brains, but that we can take control of that process back, just as we can take back control of our technologies.
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie, I wanted to turn to you. What's your read of the brain science in this area, and how do you link it back to your greater thesis around the fact that internet behavior looks like a lot of other addictive behaviors?
Read on brain science is spells out the limits of my knowledge about the brain. I am not an expert in the science of the brain. However, what I understand is the experience of the individual and the impact of the individual who becomes addicted and what the changes are in thinking and emotion, as I was talking about earlier. And my understanding of the brain, one, is that addiction really is centered in the reward circuitry and in reinforcement that gets established almost instantaneously. And I think of addiction as an attachment disorder. The individual is suddenly drawn to something. Something clicks. Consciously, oh my gosh, this is good. This is going to be a solution. This is going to help. And that sets in motion then the emotional attachment to whatever it is, which will then be regulated, fostered by the brain, as well as the individual's consciousness. And it's that conscious explanation that I work with people. Addiction is a dominance of impulse. And individuals who are addicted are arrested in their overall development at the level of about four-year-olds. Thinking gets very distorted and skewed. And again, my understanding is the brain takes over the reward and the reinforcement and the need to impulsively keep acting over and over and over again. And the emotions will often regress to very low levels of development as well, that four-year-old marker. And then what we see clinically now and what I see in the culture, I don't have to be in my office to see this everywhere, of people developing the reasons, the explanations for why they need to drink more, use more, and they don't dare get offline. As you said earlier, Joseph, I believe, you might miss something. And every single thought, emotion will reinforce the impulsivity, the need to check. And it's a very complex interaction of all of these pieces.
So I have a question for you here. Do you have a sense that there are certain people who are more prone to this than others, and what could be co-occurring factors that you're seeing here? I mean, is it people who have, an anxiety disorder, people who have ADD? I mean, or is it just sort of a general population? Is it an all-comers kind of problem?
It's an all-comers, and what a great question. And this is my impression, clearly, but it's over many years now. That, and especially here in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley, we are dominated by a culture that believes in human power, believes that we have no limits. Human beings have no limits. And along comes cyberspace to show us that technology has no limits. And people started falling by the wayside. All people, they may have been predisposed, maybe. I don't think so, because I see people who don't have other addictions, no family history, who cannot stop and believe that they're on a path to success. We have a definition of success as more, better, faster. Progress is defined as going faster and faster. Achievement, all of our identification and our identities, and I'm talking about American culture now, are linked to entitlement to go after what you want and a belief that we should be able to do it, because that was true in the past.
It's interesting to me, if you want to sort of extend this to in other ways, the fact that the more you use something, if you're taking the addiction metaphor here, although you're not calling it a metaphor, actually. But if you take the addiction metaphor, it's like you need it to get better and better and better, because that's kind of the experience of addiction, right? Is that it you are constantly chasing that initial high that you're
right.
talking about. And interesting, I would put a link to sort of capitalism, right? Capitalism is always about continuous growth. That trajectory. So it seems like things are coming together quite nicely here. I want to put out the number for our listeners to join our conversation again here on City Visions 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about so-called internet addiction with our guests. We were just hearing from Dr. Stephanie Brown. We also heard earlier from Dr. Alex Sojung Kim Pong and Dr. Nima Moraveji. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Do you feel distracted by the digital devices in your life? Do you have a friend or partner who can't stop looking at email? Is it affecting your personal relationships? What are your concerns about this topic? What are your thoughts about how we engaged youth who have been immersed in this from the very beginning? 415-841-4134. You could also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at KLW.org, or on our Facebook page. I'm just realizing how technology addicted we are here, because I've given you five ways to contact us. Anyway, 415-841-4134. As we get a few calls coming in, I wanted to check with you, Nima. Do you have anything to add to this particular topic of the brain science here?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's the way you think about how the addiction happens and what was the first time you felt you or might be, not necessarily you, but perhaps our listeners that were addicted to technology. And probably the story is somewhere around, I might see something perhaps very interesting on that network page or on the email or the text message or something, let me check. Oh, not so much, but the next time I did it, I hit the jackpot and I saw something really great, and then the next time, nothing so much. And that's what we call this random schedule of reinforcement.
Or the intermittent reinforcement.
Yeah, correct. And it's basically the notion that you never know when you're going to hit the jackpot, and this is exactly what slot machines use. And so if you notice yourself starting to, when you want to, hit the slots or check your number or check the phone, you can kind of start to develop that self-awareness around how your brain is operating without your conscious awareness.
415-841-4134. We'll go to our first caller, Khalid. Are you calling from Seattle, Khalid?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, well, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
What's your question?
Just a quick question. Is there something that we can do every day, you know, ideally a minute or less, to kind of prepare ourselves or sort of break the distraction habit? Because I know for myself, it's probably pretty likely that I will be distracted. So it's more some kind of small preventative action I can take. Is there anything I can do?
So, Nima, do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things that perhaps the simplest thing to do is use the existing times that you check your phone. Actually, you know, every time you check your phone, you probably turn it on and there's a lock screen that you might unlock in some way. And putting something on that lock screen or putting something on the screen for where you log in, you type in your password on your computer or something that develops that speed bump for you, that is perhaps a person and noticing when the effect is wearing off, of course, but creating that, having a space there where there's a space for you to unclench your abdomen, take a breath from your belly, and then engage in what you're doing. And you'll find that just by developing that habit, you won't have to kind of have that, no, I shouldn't do this, or no, I shouldn't do that. It's just kind of, before I do what I'm going to do, I change where I'm coming from. And then that habit grows other habits, and that begins to change how we use the technology much more intentionally. So I would say that's probably the most pervasive and powerful thing, other than a more formal, you know, practice that you might engage in.
So it sounds like you're looking for techniques to, well, I don't know if you call them distraction techniques, but techniques that will kind of are deliberate and purposeful and insert these pauses or speed bumps you talked about earlier that kind of recenter and kind of get your entire consciousness focused on what's actually going on as opposed to this potential loop you're caught in? Is that what you're getting at here?
Absolutely. I mean, even on the computer, I keep my applications in full screen mode, so I don't have multiple windows that I can see and kind of switch immediately between. When I need to switch tasks, it kind of goes, okay, I'm going to switch the other task, and the whole screen changes to the other full screen window. So even just these little things, just setting up our environment to be that much more like in between time, and then the fact is that when we have that in between time in the future, we'll know why we did that, we'll know why we put that moment there, and that connects to this entire notion of having the intention to not be distracted and be more present in our engagement with our technology.
Khalid, thank you so much for your call. I hope you can take some pearls from that. And quickly, Anima, have you worked with any mindfulness experts that teach mindfulness meditation to develop some of the tools that you're developing?
Yeah, actually, right now we're working with the son of Jon Kabat-Zinn. His son is Will Kabat-Zinn, and his wife, Teresa. We're working together with UCSF to develop a mindfulness-based intervention for mothers who are chronically stressed. And it's actually been a fascinating collaboration because these are people who, you know, they're mindfulness teachers, and they don't want to say technology is evil or, you know things like that. They want to figure out how to intervene in people's lives. And I'll tell you one of the interesting things that came out of it. So say you're a mother standing in line at Starbucks and, you know, you're feeling stressed and you kind of hit this button that says I'm stressed or I'm anxious, or perhaps the phone itself vibrates and says, hey, how are you feeling at this moment or something. The phone, what they told us is that we want to ask the user a question at that moment. For example, is this the best use of my time at this moment? Or what is incomplete in this moment? Or some kind of reflection question without having a text box to enter any response. Mm. And have that be the entire interaction. Because what the mindfulness teacher said is that they don't want to bring the user back into the phone to respond to it in a textual way, but rather just sit with the question. And that in itself can kind of bring them back to their own experience and their own emotions.
Alex, did you want to add something here?
Well, my lock screen right now says never watch a loading screen. And when I first turn on my iPhone, that's what I see. Because I was watching at a conference, and I noticed people, when they were checking their email on their phones, they would just, you know, watch the little ball spin, which is, when you think about it, a remarkably stupid way to sort of to spend your time when there is virtually, or you know, there's hardly an environment where there aren't more interesting things to watch than a little digital ball. But you know, the important point of Nima's work is that tools that make you more mindful about your use of technology can also ultimately help make you more mindful while you're using the technology. You know, it's not just a question of using these to kind of relieve relieve distraction, but ultimately getting to the point where you notice enough about how you use these things so that you can begin to be contemplative using social media or using your cell phone.
So, Stephanie, I'm curious here how you think of this as a psychologist, where, you know, there's the harm reduction school of addiction treatment, but there's also, you know, the abstinence. Get yourself as far away from it as possible. Replace it with something more constructive and meaning generating. How do you feel about this potential pathway that the reshaping of the technology as actually is the answer to the problem? Do you see that as a possibility, as a different path that this type of addiction could take in terms of its our addressing it?
Well, I don't think there's one answer to this problem that we're all speaking about from very different points of view. There is not one answer, and I think it's wonderful to, you know, pursue the development of technology in the service of helping people slow down. But there's a problem in this piece of the conversation as I listen, of the sense of, you know, using the same, the same substance, the same, that is the problem to try and treat it. And my sense is at some point I would want people to be able to back away, to be able to unplug and develop the relationship with themselves, separate from the mediator of technology. It's similar, you know, and people used to say, well, we're going to treat alcoholism with more alcohol. And so that was one path that was very important in research, and absolutely this sounds really wonderful. But I also would like people to be able to be focused on themselves, to be looking inward. The result of technology, and one of the big causes, is that people are focused externally and believe that the answers to everything now lie outside of themselves. This is a source of enormous insecurity, anxiety, panic, that if I let go of my devices, I am going to be utterly lost.
Just like alcoholics will say, alcohol is
a problem in the tracing of this. And the caller, if I understood the caller correctly, said, can you give me a way to slow down, basically, that will take less, you know, in a minute? And I thought, that's the place to start, is the framework that he had, I believe, that many people have, is we need to, whatever our solutions are going to be, they have to be fast. Mm-hmm. They have to be quick.
Well, because they have to replace...
People don't have to engage emotionally.
Right, because they have to replace the quickness of what they're addicted to, right?
Exactly.
And you're saying, that's not the way to go.
Exactly. And I am all about slowing down.
Slowing down.
And that is withdrawal, and it makes people anxious.
Right. 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or post a comment at kalw.org. Let's go to Karen from Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Karen.
Oh, good evening. This is such a great show. Okay, so just someone that drives, you know, I see that I'm in North Berkeley where the university is. I'll see several kids walking down the street. They're all on the phone. They're not talking to each other. They're not looking where they're going. Their ears are plugged up. A few weeks ago in the New York Times stated that 83% has gone up of kids that have these earbuds and they're on the phone have been victims of, you know, people knocking them down and stealing their purse and so forth. So they're actually becoming like a kind of a prey species. When they go to the corner, they don't look both ways. They don't have eye contact with drivers. They just step out. They don't hear anything. They don't see anything. They're not paying attention at all, and not to mention the people that are on the phone with their ears plugged up and on the still, you know, talking on the phone. So to me, and then young mothers wheeling their babies. You know, there's just millions of babies out there now. They're all on the phone. They're not engaging with their kids in the stroller, and they're certainly not paying attention to who's behind them or who's next to them. As a parent and someone who, well, I don't have an iPhone or anything like that, but it seems to me that there is a loss of engagement in conversation, in mindfulness that you're discussing, which is really important. And so it's a very insulated kind of a world that it appears to me that these kids are living in, and their ears are always plugged up. They don't hear anybody coming up behind them. So it's a kind of an irresponsibility also that I see.
Thank you so much, Karen, for your call. You know, we did a show, I can't remember now if it was a month or two ago now, about how digital technology is impacting learning in children and the concern around attention or lack thereof and the sort of social stunting of children. But one of the pieces that we came up with towards the end of the program was, you know, we're talking about children and worries about their children, but it's like, look to their parents and what kinds of modeling behavior their parents are exhibiting. So I wanted to read a comment from an actual caller who decided not to stay on the line. His name is Ed from Berkeley. And I hope it was okay to say your name, Ed, on the air. He states that he's 71 and he feels that the world is very overwhelming and he wants to connect in person, but everyone is online. And what can he do? And I don't think you have to be 71 to have that experience, I don't think. Any answers from our panel here?
Boy, does that really say it. No, you can't find people to sit down with and to have a cup of coffee with. I don't have any brilliant suggestions other than what a lot of senior people find in their senior communities where there's a lot of engagement taking place. Berkeley is a very vibrant community, and I would be looking to the community resources that still exist. And maybe directly for seniors, that may be the best place. It's something to think about, actually, to find a value of engagement, interpersonal engagement.
Yeah. Well, you know, this reminds me of a story I heard once about someone who was in a bar and found someone across the room attractive and overheard the person, you know, was commenting how attractive that person was. And the comment that was overheard was like, oh, I need to go home and see if I can find this person online so I can connect with them when they were just across the room. So, Nima, did you want to add something there? It sounded like you did.
Yeah, you know, what I would say to Ed is, in the same way that this conversation that we're having now is resonating so much with so many people because it's kind of the elephant in the room in a way, I think being explicit with other people about, hey, I want to hang out and have no phones and have no notice nothing and, like, just take a walk together, I think more and more people are actually appreciating the value of that more because they're also stressed out. It's kind of like how I often talk about how Facebook, you know, you can talk all day about the evils of Facebook, and they're all perhaps true, but, you know, it's, in a way, it served to show us the value of friendship, of eye contact, of being with someone through the thick and the thin. It's made us value it even more. So I would just kind of ride that, because otherwise, where else are you going to go? You're going to be complaining and you know, worried and anxious about all the potential anxiety. So we have to just invest as much energy as we can into what are we going to do about it. And I think being explicit about it actually resonates with a lot of people and to pick you up.
So we have a little less than 5 minutes in the program, and we have a caller that I want to get to with a very interesting question. But first, I wanted to ask this quick one. It might not be a quick answer, but it's sort of like one of those questions I have to ask, which is there any evidence out there that the companies that are creating these technologies, kind of creating them in a way to get people hooked in the first place, like, you know, like the tobacco industry? Since we're talking about addictive behaviors, we might as well throw that one out there. Is there any concern there that there's something in the way they're designed that's potentially addictive?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, wow.
I think so. Absolutely. No, and
Alex, go ahead, Alex.
I think researchers at sort of the better social media companies or software or hardware companies that put a lot of money into design are perfectly aware of work in things like sort of behavioral economics or the neuroscience of attention, and are looking for ways to make their devices just a little bit more interesting, just a little bit more addictive. One of the most brilliant industries that does this is the gambling industry. Or Vegas is this gigantic laboratory in attention capture. And they've done a phenomenal job of creating devices. Game companies do this really well, too, of creating devices that sort of simulate flow experiences, you know, that sense of being in the zone where time slows down, where you're fully engaged in an activity, where you feel yourself in control and sort of you're expressing sort of this great skill. And it used to be that when you were doing things like, let's say, rock climbing or surgery, that was a skill that sort of really sort of meant something. And it produced a kind of sensibility and a kind of resilience that sort of you could use through all of your life. It is harder to do with games, and it's certainly harder to do with slot machines, but it turns out after 20 years, it's possible to simulate that sensibility enough so that you can sort of nudge people into playing or spending just a little bit more.
And lest we be accused of being biased, I do want to note that we did reach out to several tech companies to come on the program tonight to talk about their thoughts about this and perhaps to defend themselves against Alex's assertion there, but they all declined to participate. So let's go to Bailey from Oakland. Bailey, great question that I think you have, but you got to be brief because we have less than a couple of minutes on the line.
Okay, no problem. I guess my question was, how do we trust in my generation because this technology is so new and so rapid and so encompassing? How do we trust that it's actually bad? We don't know the effects.
Okay, we'll have you take your answer off the air. Who wants to grapple with that question?
I would like to say that I do not see technology itself as the problem. I see that it's the individual that develops the problem. And technology itself is not bad or good. It's neutral. But it's the individual and what happens that becomes the problem.
And I'm sorry, you're saying there, and it's also the culture and the context around that individual, right? It's not just
absolutely
the individual.
The culture reinforces it. What I was saying earlier about beliefs and definitions of success, and we can put the blame on technology and then not take the responsibility for our own attitudes, our own wishes for success and grandiosity and the high.
And if we have a little bit of time left, so Nima, some closing comments of what you see moving forward in the work that you're doing.
Well, I think that the next wave is going to be wearable technologies, one of the big next waves. So our technologies will be on our bodies, and that's already starting to happen and will continue. And there will be some that use it in ways that it's distracting, and there will be some that use it in ways that it brings presence and mindfulness, like any other new technology that comes out. And to answer the caller's question, I think cultivate as much attention and intention as you can into how you want to live, what is your ideal for the way you think and the way you feel and the relationships you have, and then technologies will come and go, and you'll know how and when to use them and what kind to use them, because like Stephanie said, there's no good or bad. It's really about how we choose to spend our time and attention.
Okay, so basically about finding ways to take charge and not let the technology hijack us and lose control. And then, Alex, you're going to get the final word to sort of wrap this all up for us.
Great. Well, there's a great Buddhist saying that pain is inevitable, but suffering is a choice. You know, sort of you're going to get hurt in this life. The question is, do you develop the capacity to learn from those arrows? And I think likewise, we live in a world now in which connection is inevitable. You can't get away from sort of our devices. But I think what the work of what NEMA's work and sort of the work in contemplative computing shows is that distraction turns out to be a choice. Yes, we can be distracted by our devices, but we can also learn to take charge of them and to get our minds and to get our lives back.
And to basically take our consciousness back into our control.
Yes.
So that's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank my guests, Alex Soojung Kim Pong, Stephanie Brown, and Nima Moraveji. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
To a link to this and other City Visions shows, to tell us what you thought about tonight's programs, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out the City Visions page at kalw.org. I want to thank our engineer, Bob Summer. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe, and our senior producer is Susie Britton. Join our guest host, David Onick, next Monday when we check in on how the healthcare industry in California is preparing for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in 2014. This is your host, Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week and calm down.